From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Protests over the death of George Floyd while in the custody of Minneapolis police now stretch around the globe. They erupted after the release of a horrific video, which shows an excruciating 8 minutes and 46 seconds of former police officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck. Chauvin has been fired from his police job and charged with murder. Floyd has been laid to rest, but the protests have not. Early protests around the country included violence, looting, fires. In Wilmington, a May 30th protest near the 1898 memorial was peaceful and praised by local leaders. The next day, there were reports of several armed protesters, people throwing rocks and bottles, and storefront windows broken in downtown Wilmington. Local law enforcement released tear gas to disperse the crowd. Since that first weekend, nightly protests have remained largely peaceful in Wilmington. But as the narratives around protester violence vary from place to place, also emerging are reports of officers engaging in dialogue with protesters, listening to them, hugging them, taking a knee in solidarity. Over the last week, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper has created two new task forces, both to be led by women of color, both to address racial inequities in the state. The first, to be led by Secretary Michelle Sanders of the Department of Administration, is charged with looking at broad areas such as housing, economic opportunity, and health outcomes. The other task force, to be led by Justice Anita Earls, will examine criminal justice reform. New Hanover County has announced the creation of a new Office of Diversity and Equity. There are other developments in Wilmington, the Cape Fear region, North Carolina, and the country that we could examine that appear to be triggered by the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. But is that what's driving these new initiatives? What's different now, if anything? We'll explore those questions today through the lens of history. Joining me now, Glenn Harris, Associate Professor in the Department of History at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He teaches African American history and courses on social justice and liberation struggles. His most recent work, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Reflections on the Trayvon Martin Case and the American Idea, appeared in the book, The Trayvon Martin in Us, An American Tragedy. Professor Harris, welcome to Coastline.
Good afternoon, Rachel. Good afternoon.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. How do you see the protests over George Floyd's death when you look through the lens of history? Is this a crossroads? Is there a shift occurring? Or do you think this is simply the most recent national story igniting protests? You can tell us about it during the live Wednesday edition via email at coastline@whqr.org. And Professor Harris, you have said that each time Americans see the killing of an unarmed black man at the hands of law enforcement, there is outrage, there are protests, and then we eventually all go back to business as usual. Is this different? Why or why not?
I would hope it's different, Rachel. It's different in that the duration of the protests. This is week three and a half. Since the killing of George Floyd. So the duration of the protest is one. Also, the enormous number of conversations that have been sparked, the enormous number of debates that have taken place, but also in relation to a course that I teach on social justice and liberation struggles. And the essence of that course is that I look at the social justice issue in the United States, meaning Black Americans, African Americans, trying to make the United States live up to its professed values. We have these livid ideas of the American idea, understanding, but they're just ideas, and but they're not necessarily our reality. You get those social justice issues, but also because of the protests taking place after George Floyd are also abroad. They're happening in Syria. They're happening throughout Europe. So that liberation struggle, you see that particular connection between Black people, brown skinned people, that is an impressive ramification. That is an impressive affirmation of these protests that are taking place. One of the problems that I see is that when you look at George Floyd, I don't want this to be a one-off thing. So we talk about George Floyd, we can talk about Jameer Clark, we can talk about Philando Castile. And these are just names of African-Americans that were killed in and around Minneapolis. And so when we begin to understand how these things are taking place, they become very important. We can also look at Bethune June, we can look at Trayvon Martin, and we begin to see a narrative that it plays out in the last 5 years. I have seen this before. I've seen these protests before. I have heard these conversations before. If I'm just mentioning these names, I can talk about Emil Aubrey, Breonna Taylor, Deshaun Reed. I've seen these protests before. I've had these conversations before. So what is new about this time? Hopefully, if I'm, you know, and I always believe in hopefulness, hopefully that it changes how we understand what it means to be Black in American society. If not, we're going to see this again. Under no circumstances would we have thought coming out of Trayvon Martin, coming out of Deshaun Reed, and coming out of these other people that I named, that this could possibly happen again. But the cavalier way, the leisurely way in which George Floyd was killed is depressing. At best, it's depressing. Far worse is that it's detrimental to the understanding of being Black in American society. What do I see the hope about this is that the protest leads to something positive.
Let's go all the way back to Frederick Douglass in American history. Our Coastline producer, Rachel Keith, actually wrote a paper about Frederick Douglass, and this is lifted from her paper. She writes, "One day Douglass was on the brink of sickness, on the brink of death from sickness and exhaustion, refused to work." And I think this is a quotation from the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass about which she wrote. His owner began whipping him. Douglass decided to fight back. As Douglass remembers, the battle rekindled the few expiring embers of freedom and revived within me a sense of my own manhood. It recalled the departed self-confidence and inspired me again with the determination to be free. And so then Rachel Keith writes, his fighting back established him as an equal. It reestablished his own self-respect, and this culminated in his freedom. So this was a key turning point in Frederick Douglass's life, but he also kind of changed his views over time about violence and whether violence was necessary to abolish slavery. How did those conflicting views about violence develop with him, and what can we learn from them?
Okay, so when we talk about Frederick Douglass, what you referred to, what Rachel Keith wrote about, she's referring to Frederick Douglass's first autobiography. Frederick Douglass wrote three autobiographies, and so that first autobiography comes out in 1845, is going to be the definitive autobiography in African-American letters and in American letters well into the 20th century. But he wrote a second autobiography that dealt with his first 15 years of freedom. His third autobiography, which is one I'm going to refer to here, reflects on one of the questions that he asks as he's traveling throughout the United States in 1880, is simply that the United States can't remain half slave and half free. So the question he asks is, how do we create a society, an environment where race will not be so much of an issue? Not an environment where different races won't exist, but where race needs to be less of an issue. I'm going to hold up there, and I'm going to step us back to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment from 1865 to 1870, because the United States has had the unique opportunity to redo itself. It happened from 1865 to 1870. Indeed, before George Floyd, we had the opportunity coming out of these last cases to redo how we think about American society, and we don't do it. So 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment are very important in that we deal away with the institution of slavery. The 14th Amendment is arguably the most important in that it defines citizenship and that Blacks are citizens of American society. 15th Amendment gives the right to vote, but it's the most radical adjustment that we have to the Constitution in our history. The opportunity to redo the American idea where all people are as we say in the Declaration of Independence, all people are created equal. And so we do that. This violence that we are seeing, and I'm talking about the violence of George Floyd, that particular violence is one of the things that Frederick Douglass is trying to address with that particular question. But the violence that comes through people rejecting change. So we redo American society, we reestablish under the principles of the Constitution, and the immediate violence that takes place, the reaction to the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, leads to the aspect of lynching in American society. Between 1880 and 1920, over 3,000 primarily Blacks are lynched by whites, and it becomes a public spectacle. And in between that, we have Frederick Douglass. And so, but also we have these things that are gonna be very prevalent to Wilmington, North Carolina. First, we have the 1890 census that is gonna come into play. We have Plessy versus 1890 census. We have Plessy versus Ferguson that happens in 1896. And in 1898, we have the Wilmington race riots. And all of these things are coming into play. So when Frederick Douglass asks, how do we create a society, not where different races don't exist, but where race needs to be less of an issue, one of the things that is gonna come into play is, he argues, is that the ideal of miscegenation, which is race mixing. When we talk about race mixing, we're gonna talk about the issue of diversity and why that is a problem, because diversity for the sake of diversity is one thing, but how white people see diversity is that it is a minimizing of whiteness in American society. And there's gonna be a terrific backlash to that. On this, I will begin to pick up as soon as we come back.
Thank you for that. You're listening to Coastline. We're taking a closer look at the protests over George Floyd's death through the lens of American civil rights history. Professor Glenn Harris of UNCW's History Department is with us today. We want to hear from you. What do you think about the protests? Are they different from the past? Tell us about it or ask your own question during the live Wednesday discussion. Email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Protests over the death of George Floyd are taking place nightly in downtown Wilmington. Organizers say they have a permit to continue into the next year. Professor Glenn Harris of UNCW's History Department is with us today to examine these protests through the lens of social justice battles and liberation struggles over the decades in America, and he's answering your questions during the live Wednesday discussion. How do you see these protests? What's your experience with them? Send us an email at coastline@whqr.org, and in just a moment, we're going to hear from Brian. But first, Professor Harris, you were unpacking the questions that Frederick Douglass raises that we are still trying to answer today.
Yeah, and why Douglass? Douglass is a premier figure in African-American letters and in American letters. Okay, so when he makes that statement in 1880, that the United States didn't remain half slave and half free, 10 years later, we have the 1890 census. And the 1890 census is the first census that we have of African-Americans that were not born into institutional slavery, they were born in a society of integration. So between 1865 and 1896, we live in an integrated society. But the 1890 census really is taking exception to this, even as much as, so this is in tandem with the lynchings that are taking place. The 1890 census becomes the first time that the census is used to draw a statistical link between Blackness and criminality in American society, meaning that the race, Blacks as a race, are beginning to look at and be perceived as criminals. And so you try and figure out, so Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, why does that happen in 1896? You have the Supreme Court that passed these three amendments, but how does Plessy versus Ferguson come into play, where all these things make it possible for Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896? It doesn't just happen in a vacuum. 1896 takes away the ideal of integration, brings segregation back into American society. And whites in American society begin to perceive, coming out of the 1890 census, that Blacks are responsible, their presence in society, being perceived as criminals, that they are responsible for the levels of racism, prejudice, and discrimination. So they begin to be perceived as a problem. Hence the essay that I wrote on Trayvon Martin, what does it feel like to be a problem? W.E.B. Du Bois, at the turn of the century, writes this incredible book in 1903, The Souls of Black Folk. It's impressive on any number of levels, not the least of which he's going to simply say that the problem of the 20th century is going to be the problem of the color line. When we have these, when we start this particular conversation coming in the century, what is going to become paramount is how do we define race in American society?
And I want to get to Brian's question, because you raised this issue in terms of the color line and how we talk about things. And he says, I think one of the problems is the way we talk about these events, words and syntax matters. I hear all the time, it's bad to talk about what happened to George Floyd, but the looting and violence has to end. Why not? I feel really bad about the looting and violence, but the lynching of young Black men and women for the crime of being Black in public has to end. What would you say to Brian? I mean, how much has changed since the early 20th century?
Here's the direct critique I have for Brian. Here's the problem, is that we play a game of deflection by not addressing what is at the core issue of what is taking place. You minimize it. And so we want to talk about, you know, the problems that are coming out of the loot and as opposite as opposed to what took place. We don't want to talk about race, because when we talk about race in American society, what that requires is for white Americans to look at all the issues and all the dilemmas, all the conflicts that have arisen out of not addressing this issue and dealing with it directly. What we failed to do coming out of the Civil War is directly have the conversation about race in American society. We said integration, but what it means to be Black in American society is paramount, and how that is addressed. You know, for me, and I tell people that if I think it's easier to define what it means to be Black in American society, obviously what it means to be white in society, but there's a caveat to this, because we're so simplistic in the United States is that if you're not white, you're Black, whether you're Native American, whether you are Hispanic, whether you are Asian. If you are not white, you are perceived as Black. And we're so simplistic in the United States, looking at things through a lens of just Black and white, we can put everybody in that marginalized. So as we treat Blacks, it's how we can treat everybody. There's a reason why, you know, when we have these conversations, that under no circumstances do I think that white people can't not recognize Blacks in American society. But under no circumstances would any white person change positions with a Black person in the United States. That's one level. On this second level, in all that Blacks have to deal with in American society, there's not one Black in American society, one African American, that would choose not to be Black, that would choose not to be African American. And that's important. I don't mind white Americans say that, no, I would not choose to be Black. That's fine. And that's not even the issue for me. What is more the issue is, well, why wouldn't you? Because to address that would let you know that why race matters. So when W.E.B. Du Bois says the problem 20th century is going to be the problem of the color line, what he's really getting at is that you have to understand what it means to be Black in American society.
And well, can we talk about some of the well-meaning white folks who mm-hmm. say that they're colorblind, for instance? I think you quoted Ross Posnock's skepticism is useful to the extent it reminds us that colorblind rhetoric and discourses, legal and cultural, have long been a favorite ideological camouflage to affirm the status quo. This is colorblindness is often held up as by white people, I think, as a mm-hmm. virtuous position. I'm not racist because I'm colorblind. But what does that mean? What do you hear?
If I'm going to be direct, and I'm going to be, that is facetious at best. I can just come, that's a joke at best, because you're talking about even, and what goes along with that line being colorblind is that race is a social construct. And I give a lot of respect and a lot of space to my academic peers that make that argument that race is a social construct, except that we live in a society, as George Floyd clearly makes clear, that race exists. And it's not a, even if it's a social construct, it exists, and people die because of the color of their skin. George Floyd is just one in the long line of names that I've just talked about, of people who are dying because of the race of their skin. Social construct or whatever, race exists, and it's a very real issue. For me, being Black in Wilmington, North Carolina, I'm a professor, I'm an author, I talk about these issues, and I still have to be careful about how I adjust myself in society. I have, as I walk down the street, I mentioned that after Aubrey got killed for running, when he's jogging in the middle of the day and he was running, I run at 5:30 in the morning. I run with, I have a running vest, a reflector running vest on. I have a headlight that I wear on my head. My headlight didn't work the next day. And I refused to go out and run at 5:30 in the morning. And you understand, me making that statement is an incredible statement to make. I refuse to run outside in my community because I didn't have a headlight, because something could happen. And for me to address that in any other fashion could be detrimental to me. And so I recognize very well that I'm Black in a society, but also from the time I was 8, Rachel, I'm 55 right now, from the time I was 8 till 55, every year of my life, there are at least 3 incidents, at least 3, that let me know that I am white, that I am Black in American society, and I am not white, meaning that dichotomy that we spoke about earlier. What does it mean to be Black in a society? What does it mean to be white in society? Well, if you're not white, you're Black. And that's everybody. I recognize that every year of my life, 3 times. And I'm being generous here because it's actually more than that. The colleagues and the friends that I talk to, we have these conversations. I don't think there's any Black person that may be listening to this that would disagree with me, that they have these particular type of events that come into play. And to bring it back, so what we're really talking about, this issue about race, and to say that color doesn't exist, that I'm colorblind. Look, I never fail to recognize race and gender in American society. I never fail to recognize race and gender when I leave the United States. I look at it as it is, and I see it as it is. To say that you're colorblind, I don't agree with that. Under no circumstances do I agree with that, because these instances let me know that, yeah, if you say race doesn't exist, then give me the context for all of these issues that are happening and all these deaths that are taking place in American society. And I'm a historian. I know race exists in American society.
And you talk about knowing experientially what it means to be tall, Black, and bald in America,
yes,
as you describe yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're hearing about these conversations, and we're also seeing more essays from journalists of color who write about their own personal experiences. Shola Richards, a successful Black journalist, essayist, writes about living in an affluent neighborhood, how he takes his young daughters and his little white dog with him when he goes out for a walk for fresh air. He writes, "I'm not a threat to anyone. I'm simply trying to exist and get some fresh air. These experiences aren't uncommon for Black men." And he's talking about people who don't know that he lives in the neighborhood, looking through their curtains while they're on their cell phones. And he writes, "It's difficult to explain the death by a thousand paper cuts feeling that we have to endure because of this. Additionally, as a highly sensitive person, it's more than exhausting. It's soul destroying." You keep, Professor Harris, talking about us not just looking at the event that triggered these protests and the public outrage over George Floyd alone, but looking at the causes and looking at what it means to be Black in America. What does that really mean? Can you help us understand that? You talked about refusing to go running without all your running gear because you want to look like a runner when you're out on the street at 5:30 in the morning.
I want to look non-threatening.
Right.
The quote that you just used, Rachel, I'm like, who does that? Who has to do that? In an affluent society, middle class, who has to concern themselves with that? Can't just living their lives on a day-to-day basis. Now, mind you, before he wrote about that particular issue, those things took place. there are a number of issues that take place on a day-to-day basis that African-Americans don't even talk about where race is concerned. Just some of these major issues, but we deal with this on a day-to-day basis. And so as I look at this and I'm trying to unpack all these particular issues for me about what it means to be Black in American society, I'll even be more specific, what it means to be Black in Wilmington, North Carolina, is to recognize that occasionally, but consistently, I'm perceived as being different. You know, I'm on this news program and I'm being heard by our audience and our listeners. And I take this to heart. I take that responsibility to heart, but it is also part of my responsibility trying to convey these ideas, trying to convey these things that are taking place. When I look at these events, I also look at the ideas that are sparking them. So what made it possible is one thing, but what is the outcome? What is the intellectual outcome of these things that I'm speaking about? For me, is to adjust in American society that we have to have these conversations, because in my circle of friends, and in my realm, we have these conversations on a day-to-day basis. What I think is missing, as I spoke to earlier, is that white Americans, for the most part, don't talk about race and race issues and the ideas that spark them, the ideas that are coming out, and to the extent that African Americans do, because, as I said, who has to do that? Who has to wake up in the morning and understand that, look, if I'm going to go outside, I need to take my daughter with me so I can appear less threatening? Who has to wake up in the morning and cannot run because their light doesn't work? Who can be out running and can see a young white woman with a walk and a dog and understand that they have to go to the other side of the street? Who gets pulled over and before they do anything have to put their hands on a steering wheel and not move? Who has to do that?
You do that, right?
I don't. Yeah.
That's part of your.
That's my point. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't have the luxury not to do that. I know a number of white people who have the luxury to not even consider that. It doesn't even come up in their conversation. But those are the conversations that need to be had. So I know where my conversations are taking place and I know who I can reach out to. But what I'm looking for are the conversations that are being sparked by the incredible amount of diversity that's involved in these protests. Those people that are non-Black, who are they talking to? Who are they having their conversations with? And what is the nuance of the conversations that they're having? Those are the conversations that need to take place. To not be able to talk about race is only an issue because you are not talking about race. You can't be, I don't want you to be apprehensive or lackadaisical about your approach when you're looking at race. You just simply have to have the conversation. Well, how do I have it? You know, the facetious thing is white people say, well, I don't have any Black friends. Well, you need to get some Black friends. But it's not just the point about having Black friends. You have to engage those friends. A friend is not a friend unless you're really having a conversation with them. You know, and so, you know, these things are very real. Part of being Black in American society is understanding these nuances of what I'm talking about, to understand what the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment was about, to understand what Frederick Douglass was talking about, to understand the nuances of the 1890 census, to understand Plessy versus Ferguson and how this is going to take us to Du Bois and how this will take us to Brown versus Board of Education and will bring us eventually into where we are having this conversation about George Floyd.
So you're talking about white people taking it upon themselves to educate themselves about not just Black history, but the Black experience. And there are lots of resources available for that. And so that may have partially answered Joe's question, but he says, what can I do as a white person to help facilitate improving the lives of people of color without being called a sympathizer? What else would you say to Joe?
Just speak to them, speak to me, speak to your friends. And so, and I understand we're talking about three degrees of separation. If you don't have any white, if you don't have any friends of color, if you don't have any Black friends, you know, 3 degrees of separation, you're going to come across it. I'm speaking about the people that you may come across on your day-to-day base. I'm talking about the people that you may work with, the people that you may see as you're going to the grocery store. You know, these conversations have to be had. Also, have those conversations, as I just stated, with your friends. Those conversations have to take place. Outside of that, volunteer and be productive members in your community. When you see these issues, and so you say, well, where am I complicit in maintaining American society and what happens in Wilmington? Where am I complicit in that? when these issues come up, and they're going to come up, by make no mistake, these issues are going to come up. When they come up, if you don't address them and address them directly, you're being complicit in this. You're being complicit in how race maintains this antagonistic environment for everybody. If you don't address them every single time they come up, when you have friends that make racist statements or are flipping in their commentary about people of color, if you don't address that, you're being complicit in this. So I immediately tell them to be involved and be directly involved in no shortage of terms.
We have an email from someone who says they're a former student of yours. Chris says, Dr. Harris, I grew up in an urban area filled with people from all different demographics. Now I live in a largely white area with very little diversity across religion, socioeconomic levels. What can I do to ensure my children understand and have empathy for people of color and their struggles when my children are not interacting with these people on a regular basis? Besides, in our home, the adults around them are not leading important conversations like this. So how can I do enough? What would you say to Chris?
They're your kids. Chris, they're your kids. And thirdly, Chris, they're your kids. You're the parent, especially coming from a diverse environment. You are responsible for exposing them to these things, whether it is in the environment where you live. You have to expose them. You cannot come from this diverse environment and go into an environment that has less than that and not be able to understand what is missing. And when we come back, I'll speak to this in Wilmington, North Carolina.
You're listening to Coastline. Today, it's a look at the nightly protests in Wilmington, the ongoing protests around the country after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Professor Glenn Harris is with us to provide a deeper dive into America's history of social justice reform. You can tell us your own view of the protests by sending an email during the live Wednesday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, more from listeners. It's also the last segment, so you have just a few minutes left to get your own question or comment in during this live Wednesday discussion. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. To Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, George Floyd has been laid to rest, but the protests over his death at the hands of a now fired Minneapolis police officer have not. Nightly protests continue in downtown Wilmington. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper has launched two separate task forces to address racial inequities. New Hanover County has created a Department of Diversity and Equity, and a petition to change the name of Hugh McRae Park in Wilmington has nearly 10,000 signatures as of June 10th, Wednesday morning. Professor Glenn Harris of UNCW's Department of History is with us today to examine the protests and these developments after decades of civil rights struggles. You can ask your own question or tell us about your experience, your view of the protests, by sending an email during the live Wednesday discussion to coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And Professor Harris, just before we went to break, you promised you were going to tell us about what we can do right here in Wilmington.
Yeah. Okay, so, and this is a play off of Chris's question.
And this is, Chris, just to remind listeners, Chris's question was about living in an area that is predominantly white, not much diversity, and Chris wanted to know how she can educate her children about the importance of diversity and relationships and racial equity.
Sir. You know, the environment that she speaks about is Wilmington, North Carolina. And this was moving to Wilmington was a seamless adjustment for me, in that when you come into Wilmington, what you understand almost immediately is the level of segregation and the level of racism that's prevalent in the city. But if you're a Southerner, and I grew up in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and so coming into Wilmington and recognizing this environment of Wilmington, it's seamless in that I already understand it. I grew up in this, I live in the South, so what is presented in Wilmington, I see that, and I have to make those adjustments. if you are from out of North Carolina, and particularly if you're coming from the North or you're coming from the Midwest and you come into North Carolina and you come into Wilmington, the lack of diversity can be shocking. The level of segregation can be shocking. And the level of racism, I mean, blatant racism, can be shocking. And so you have to make that adjustment to that. And so how do you do that? Well, you have to, when you can challenge it, you have to, you want to do that. Not forcefully, but at times it may have to be forcefully, depending on how it can be projected to you. And other times you just have to address the issues when they come up. You know, these particular ideas, these particular arguments are in Wilmington, and to recognize that it becomes very important. For me as a professor at the university, I have to understand the centrality that UNC Wilmington plays in the city of Wilmington, North Carolina. And it's a central position. I take it very serious as a professor of African American history that I have to be a part of my community, that I have to be out here, that I have to push these issues, that I have to push these ideas, that I have to challenge it. And so when there is a lack of diversity, you push for that. Whenever there's an opportunity to increase diversity, what diversity brings, diversity of ideas, diversity of perspectives, racial diversity, of course, that these things are, they're very important in the society. To not have those addressed just maintains the situation that we're in, and it makes it more possible for a George Floyd issue to take place, for a Zamir Rice issue to take place. And that's what I am trying to avoid and trying to prevent. And so in a diverse society, these things become very paramount for me. And I mentioned that to Chris, I would mention that to anybody else, that understand the environment that you're coming into.
We have an email from George who writes, "It appears the protests in response to George Floyd's death are more broad than past protests following similar incidents. Instead of focusing primarily on one incident and one or more, quote, bad actors, the current protests are calling for accountability for the officers charged and systemic police reform." He writes, "Additionally, corporations are publicly and actively responding to the protests by changing their business practices. We have finally come to recognize that unless and until the system that allows or even condones heinous acts is addressed, the acts themselves will continue." And he says hi to Dr. Harris. Now, I want to ask you, Professor Harris, there are moments in an all-white room, if there is blatant racism, well-meaning white people who are responsible, engaged citizens, will speak up and they will say something. But there are probably millions of little ways that well-meaning white people aren't even aware that they are allowing systemic racism to continue, things that aren't so obvious. Can you talk about some of the ways that many of us may be blind to our complicity in perpetuating some of this systemic racism?
So I'll pick up with the George Floyd issue, because you know that's the foundation of our conversation. You ask yourself, how was it possible for that particular incident to take place? When you watch that murder, you see that police officer, and I don't mention his name by intent, because I have yet to hear him say George Floyd's name, so I don't say his name. But when you look at the casual nature and the leisurely way in which he did that, and you have people watching this, I mean, you had four officers around him that are watching this, that do nothing. But this is not the first time. When you look at these protests, why these protests are interesting, and once again, I'm coming back to that, it's not just because of the breadth and the depth of them, is that this is not new. We had these protests in 2015 and 2016. We had these protests when Colin Kaepernick decided to take a knee, and the issue that we were talking about was police brutality, we're talking about poverty, we're talking about discrimination. That conversation that we initiated was attempted to be co-opted to make it disrespecting the American flag. And, you know, we poo-pooed that conversation, we laughed at that conversation because you didn't hear us. And that's what these protests are about. You see, when these corporations are taking place, it's like, look, we told you about this. We said this when Trayvon Martin was murdered. We said this when Breonna Taylor was murdered. We said this when Zamir Rice was, we said this. And so you didn't hear our voices. So understand something. It's not like our voices that we are not talking about these things. What happens again, because they are so detrimental, visually so detrimental, there are a number of white people that don't want to talk about this, but you do not. You have to stop taking the leisurely attitude to not address it. You simply have to address it. And so once again, these conversations are being had. And when you talk about there are millions, or we'll say there are hundreds of whites that see these issues that don't know how to address it. Once again, you don't know how to address it because you don't address it. There's no right way or wrong way to address this. You simply have to. When we look at these conversations that are taking place coming out of George Floyd and these protests and the dimension of these protests, what is great about them is that there's no hesitation about having conversations. The only problem with the conversation is if you choose not to have a conversation about it. And you can't do that. There's not a right way or a wrong way. You can't go into this thinking that I may say the wrong thing. Well, saying the wrong thing perhaps is worse than saying nothing at all. You're only going to figure out what is the right thing to say by saying something.
Going back to comparing what we're seeing in 2020 with what we might have seen, say, in the 1960s, mm-hmm. we've heard stories about law enforcement officials in other towns and cities around America having conversations with protesters. We've seen pictures of law enforcement officials taking a knee in solidarity with the protesters. Does this difference in response, I mean, when you compare that to law enforcement response to civil rights protesters specifically in the 1960s, and you think about the fire hoses and the dogs, is this real change that we're seeing now?
It's real understanding. And so hopefully what is sparking that is that you hear the conversations. Not only do you hear the conversations, you feel the conversation. Not only do you feel the conversations, you recognize this, what has taken place. And so when you see these protesters, that they're speaking about this, when you hear somebody describe George Floyd and he's saying that I can't breathe, one of the most profound comments that I heard is somebody said that when he was saying I can't breathe, I'm trying to breathe for him. When you hear these protesters say you don't feel my pain, when I see these, some of these police officers perhaps step even in uniform stepping out of the fact that they're law enforcement, but they're also human, that they're also Black men, and that they do understand that. So when the protest takes a knee, I take a knee with you because I understand what it is about. It is not about the flag. It is about these issues that we're talking about. That is impressive to see. More of that needs to be done. And that is completely opposite of what was taking place in the 1960s, in that the reaction to that, once again, the reaction to change, what Brown versus Board of Education allowed us to do, again, was to reestablish the American idea of reestablish the American principle. The violent reaction to that opportunity, civil rights movement, the violent reaction to that, and that is what took place. Initially, the reaction to the protest was to confront the protesters as if, you, once again, you don't want to hear the argument. We just want to suppress what is taking place. If you take a moment, relax, listen to what they have to say. A number of the elements that took place where you have the rioting and you have the looting, that wouldn't have taken place. If you would have just calm, approach that and not trying to suppress it, but listen to it and give them some space and some margin to have their voices heard, those protests wouldn't have become violent.
You know, Josh Stein, North Carolina's attorney general, pointed out he thinks North Carolina can be a leader in identifying hate and systemic racism, specifically in the criminal justice system. And he pointed to a couple of things that have happened in North Carolina, including the NAACP in North Carolina filing more lawsuits around this issue than any other, and he pointed to the Greensboro sit-ins. When we look at some of those nonviolent tactics, is that what really creates change? I mean, the sit-ins were Martin Luther King Jr.'s MO. Nonviolence was the word of the day, and it was what those protesters took to heart. Is that what creates change? Or do you, at certain points, like Frederick Douglass, need to engage in battle?
Both of those need to take place. This is not a one-tier approach to, you know, to race in society. So you need a Dr. Martin Luther King professing his ideas about direct nonviolence. But I understand something. He wasn't always about, you know, direct nonviolence. And so, but if you have a King, you also have to have a Malcolm X on this side also, because you have to understand, if you're not going to deal with Martin Luther King on his terms, then you're going to have to deal with somebody like Malcolm X on his terms. But that's a two-tier approach to what is taking place. It's not one way. When you look at the Greensboro sit-ins and the Greensboro Four, that is no different than, say, the Wilmington 10 that was taking place in the 1970s. Those issues are directly related. You don't have a Wilmington 10 without having, you don't have a Wilmington 10 without having the Greensboro Four. And I understand something, those particular events, you have them in every state. If you go into South Carolina and you go into Orangeburg, South Carolina, you have an event that's surrounded around a particular number of African-Americans. If you go into Delaware during the desegregation movement, Delaware's reaction to Brown versus Board of Education, you have the Delaware 10 that comes into play. Once again, you have to have more than one approach to what has taken place.
Professor Harris, we have just a couple of minutes left, and this anonymous writes, my dad doesn't want to be made to feel guilty. We're talking about a white guy, by the way. And what would you say to somebody like that? This, to me, is along the lines of when people say Black Lives Matter, they come back with All Lives Matter. Why are you hammering this? I'm not a racist.
Okay, so once again, to attempt to circumvent that conversation that Black Lives Matters, oh no, we can't talk about that. What we're gonna say is that all lives matter. Don't circumvent the conversation, allow that conversation to take place. Insofar as feeling guilty, guilty about what? Stop feeling guilty. Stop feeling, what do you have to feel guilty about? I'm not giving you that type of space to say, I don't wanna feel guilty, then don't. How do you address what needs to be addressed? I pound this because it needs to be pounded. Meaning that you have to hear the conversation that needs to take place, not the conversation you want to take place. What is the conversation that needs to take place? When we talk about Black Lives Matters, understand something, what we are talking about. We never said that all lives don't matter. What we're trying to get across to you is that simply that that Black Lives Matters. So once again, George Floyd, Jamar Clark, Philando Castile, we can go there. Or I can go to, once again, Deshaun Reed, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Bethon James, Trayvon Martin. When we talk about the Ezell Ford, Michael Brown, I can keep going on. These lives matter. These lives matter. And don't come back to me because you don't want to talk about this. I say, no, you shouldn't say that. Say all lives matter. Look, this is the conversation that takes place. We're trying to circumvent that conversation. I'm not going to give you the space or the margin to do that.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Professor Glenn Harris, thank you so much for being with us today.
Rachel, this is fantastic. This is fantastic. Thank you very much for having me.
Rachel Keith is the producer of Coastline. Ken Campbell is technical director. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.